Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. The Iranian government says it is entitled to defend its country following Israel's airstrikes overnight last night on military targets near Tehran. A series of strikes hit several locations, killing two Iranian soldiers. But the authorities have played down the damage and the significance of the attacks, while Israel says it has achieved its aims. Let's hear live now from Parham Gubadi from BBC Persian, who's been monitoring reporting of all this in the Iranian media and engaging reaction among members of the public there. Parham, what are people saying? Are they giving clues as to how severe these strikes were?
So there are mixed reactions to the attack. When the explosions took place almost at the same time last night, it was midnight after midnight here local time, and many people messaged me personally and saying that they were scared because they woke up to the sounds of explosions in Tehran. Later on, we realized that there were three waves of attacks. So the first one, it was in western and southwestern Tehran. We didn't see any images, no videos came out. But after a few hours, when the second and the third waves unfolded, especially in the eastern part of Iran, videos started surfacing, showing Iranian air defense missile systems getting activated and engaging with projectiles in the skies of Tehran. Now, these are some surreal scenes for many Iranians, including myself, because the last time Iranian, especially residents of Tehran that have seen such scenes, goes back to 35 years ago, when I was almost 6 years old, and I'm now over 42 years. So it has been 35 years that Iranians haven't seen, a bombardment or, aerial engagement like that in the skies of Tehran.
And given that, perhaps it's not surprising that the official government response is first that it's obliged to retaliate, but it also says we have a responsibility for maintaining peace in the region. Is that a familiar response to an attack?
So it appears that Iranians are still calculating. So they are not ruling out the retaliation. At the same time, they're not saying that, they would definitely retaliate. What they're saying is somewhere between the lines that this is our right to retaliate, but they don't say for sure and definitely that they're retaliating. It seems that it's like the previous time. They are still calculating, especially after Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran was assassinated. They were using the same lines. And there was not enough motive in Iran to retaliate. But then after Hassan Nasrallah was assassinated in Beirut, then, Iran changed its strategy and struck Israel for the second time in an operation that was called True Promise 2.
Do ordinary Iranians feel they are at war with Israel? If not, to what extent is that something they want to avoid?
So Iranian society overall, it's extremely divided over Israeli issue and Israeli-Palestinian war and what's going on in Gaza. So I think Iran is maybe the only Muslim country in the world that has a good number of people in Iran are sympathetic towards Israelis, which is a rare thing for a Muslim country. However, in the last night attacks, four Iranian army officers were killed. And it's important to note that Iran has two parallel military forces. One is the regular army that is focused is on defending the borders, and the other one is the Revolutionary Guards that is involved in extraterritorial activities from Yemen to Levant bordering Israel and in brutal crackdown of the protests in Iran. So there's a huge amount of grievance against Revolutionary Guards. But the four officers who were killed last night, they were Iranian army officers. And that created a huge sympathy and changed the mood of many Iranians.
Many thanks, Parham Gubadi from BBC Persian. So has Israel listened to the US and restrained its attacks? If that is what happened, it won't be welcome news to many in the Israeli government who hoped for a more severe response to the missiles Iran fired at Israel at the beginning of this month. Simcha Rotman is a member of parliament in Israel for the Religious Zionist Party, a far-right member of the governing coalition. I asked if he was satisfied with the Israeli response last night.
I think that to talk about the response only to the missiles, I think it's a mistake. Israel needs to respond to Iran and to actually not only to respond, to eliminate the threat from Iran, not only the missiles threat. We all know that basically what we saw from Hamas and what we saw from Hezbollah and what we're seeing from Iraq and Yemen is funded and operated by Iran. So I think to look at the response only, you shot missile and that you shot a missile, a few missiles, 100 missiles, and now we're responding to the missiles, I think it's a mistake. And I think the state of Israel must do whatever in its powers to eliminate the threat that Iran poses to Israel and to the world, not only as a response for a missiles attack.
And in the light of that, was the overnight attack on Iran adequate from your point of view?
The only thing that will be adequate is when Iran will not pose a threat. Does this attack the final word? Let's wait and see. But the adequate response, again, response and the way to treat Iran is when Israel will not be under threat, not from Iran directly and not from any of its proxies.
Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, says that Israel chose the targets in Iran based on its national interests, not according to what was dictated by the United States. Do you think the government caved in to pressure from the Biden administration to limit the extent of the strikes?
I think that what Prime Minister Netanyahu said about choosing the targets, I think it's true, I think, and I hope that the response and the reaction to Iran's hostility is not to be looked on only by what happened last night.
But U.S. pressure wasn't relevant?
I think U.S. pressure is a problem when dealing with all the threats that we are facing. We just saw documents released from Yahya Sinwar that thank God we got rid of him. But before he died, thankfully by the hands of the IDF, he wrote that the pressure that the U.S. administration put on Israel was encouraging him to put more demands and deny the release of the hostages. I think the U.S. administration learned, I hope, from its errors in the past, but it's still the pressure from the United States throughout the entire war in Gaza, in Lebanon, or against Iran, is not doing good to the safety of the world and to the safety of Israel.
President Biden clearly measures them in one night's operation. He says that Israel seems to have only hit Iranian military sites, and he says, my hope is this is the end. Do you agree?
My hopes are this is not the end, and my hopes are that Israel will do whatever it takes to eliminate the threat that Iran poses to Israel and the entire free world. And I think we see and we hear a lot of voices, even from within United States political players, that do exactly that.
That was Simcha Rotman, a member of the Israeli parliament for the Religious Zionist Party, which is a far-right member of the governing coalition. Let's speak now live to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. And Lise, President Biden has said, as I mentioned there, that he hopes Israel's strikes on Iran mark the end of retaliation by either side. Is Washington right to think there might at least be a pause in hostilities now?
Well, what we've been hearing is that whatever President Biden says, that both Iran and Israel will make their own decisions. The Prime Minister was very quick, you know, after the Sabbath ended, to put out a statement to deny all of these reports that Israel had heeded his warnings not to attack nuclear and oil installations. Iran, of course, has to be mindful of what the Americans say. It doesn't want to get entangled in a wider war, which would draw in the Americans. That could be catastrophic for Israel. But Iran has its own interests as well. And besides, President Biden only has months to go, and it's still not clear who will prevail in the U.S. election. So his days are counted.
Does Israel risk looking weak in the way it attacked Iran, not choosing economic targets?
No. Iran, as Prime Minister Netanyahu says, well, it decided according to its national interests. I think what is clear is that this is just the beginning for Israel, that they chose the military targets. And I think the American pressure may have had some bearing on that. But if you listen to all of the politicians right across the political spectrum, even the centrist Yair Lapid, who was the first to come out because he didn't mind breaking the Jewish Sabbath and said that Iran didn't pay high enough of a price. And then you have Ben-Gvir, who is a far right politician who had been calling for attacks on the nuclear facilities. He basically said this is the opening blow. And I think this is the opening. Israel sees itself as having this window. Prime Minister Netanyahu has spent his whole career warning about the nuclear threat posed by Iran. He sees Iran as an existential threat. And there may be something in the reports which say he's waiting to see what happens after the American elections. President Trump is unpredictable, of course. He could change tack. But what he is saying so far is that President Biden is wrong to try to tie Israeli hands. So all of the talk out of Israel is that, to use Prime Minister Netanyahu's phrase, he wants to change the balance of power. If they want to stop the attacks against Israel, they know they have to go to the source of the so-called ring of fire, and that's Iran.
And just talk us through Iran's choices now.
They're not very good. All the choices are bad. So far, it's trying to take control of the narrative by expressing, as it always does after these attacks, we saw it in April, dismissing them, saying there was limited damage. In this case, because Israel acknowledged for the first time that this was an Israeli attack, Iran had to then acknowledge that it was attacked by Israel. It did say that four of its soldiers were killed. It talked about limited damage, but already tonight we are getting reports of the satellite imagery, which shows damage at some of the military sites. But Iran will continue to say at home that they're already claiming success. The Iranian state media are saying we repelled the Israeli attacks. Our defenses were working. We pushed the Zionist enemy back. But they will have to take a long, hard look. The Iranian Revolutionary Guards, the ultra-conservatives around the supreme leader, may mount a warm, muscular response, but their defenses may have been really damaged in these first strikes.
Many thanks. That's our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, live here on NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Coming up on the programme, we hear from a celebrated chef in Texas with Mexican roots on Tex-Mex cuisine.
You know, the Texas terrain, you know, flour tortillas became kind of the vehicle for that workforce that needed a taco, right? Just get a taco, put it in, let's get on the road, let's get to work. This Tex-Mex cuisine that we've grown up around, I think it's gone through a transition. Sometimes Tex-Mex food gets a bad rap sometimes, but it is just part of that evolution.
The news headlines this hour. President Biden has said he hopes Israel's overnight strikes on Iran mark the end of retaliation between the two sides. And preliminary results from a key parliamentary election in Georgia put the governing party there in the lead. The opposition, though, has also claimed victory. We'll be talking about Georgia soon on this programme. I'm Paul Henley. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC. Leaders of the Commonwealth have ended their summit in Samoa with a call for meaningful talks on the legacy of transatlantic slavery. The final communique says the time has come for a truthful conversation. The bloc brings Britain together with many of its former colonies. It defied the UK by raising the issue at the gathering after Britain ruled out paying reparations. Professor Keyindi Andrews teaches black studies at Birmingham City University here in the UK. He is a campaigner for reparations to former slave nations, and he gave me his reaction to the new Commonwealth communique.
To be honest, I think this is just a PR spin. Keir Starmer made it very clear in his first, we're not going to apologise and we're not going to talk about reparations. There's been pressure now, certainly, from the meeting of the Commonwealth, mostly members of the former empire. And I think, to be honest, I think this is PR spin. I think it's just words on a document, and I don't think it will lead to much actual serious talk.
Some of the foreign ministers disagree with you. Frederick Mitchell from the Bahamas said the UK would eventually have to pay. What do you think about his opinion?
Well, I think on some senses, I actually worry about reparations because the Caribbean community has this set of demands. Well, it kind of calls across the former empire. And I do think something may happen, but I doubt it will be anything serious.
How would the amount of reparations be worked out?
The estimates from the Caribbean, this is just for Caribbean, from Britain, is between 3 and 14 trillion. The reason that number is so different is because you can just count unpaid labour, so 300 years of unpaid labour, compound that and work out what that is. But there's also the trauma, which is why you get that variety between 3 and 14 trillion.
The vastness of that sum makes it unlikely, surely, that such a precedent would be set, and presumably other European countries would feel the pressure to follow suit.
Well, this is why you won't get an apology. Well, there won't be a formal apology, because once you apologise, that suggests culpability. Once Britain then says, look, we have to pay this debt, then India can come in and say, well, the Indian debt could be, that could be 44 trillion. Africa would also claim reparations. So yes, the numbers are big, they should be big. But you're right, that does also mean that's why it's probably unlikely we ever get any serious payments.
Is everyone in a post-colonial country like Britain really made significantly richer by this history of slavery? Someone at the bottom of the social heap, someone who barely earns enough to pay taxes, might think it's ridiculous to take money off them and give to some country in the Caribbean.
Well, yeah, I mean, the question I would simply ask is why there are so many people, millions of people that migrate from the Caribbean to Britain. I'm not seeing poor people from the UK migrate the other way. And why is that? Because the conditions of life in places like Jamaica, where my families are from, for the poor, are so vastly different and disparate to the people at the bottom here. Not to mention places like Nigeria and Africa, where the life expectancy is 54. Actually, the whole migrant crisis that we have of people coming in to the UK, predominantly from foreign parts of the British Empire, is because the standards of living are so vastly different. That's what the empire has created. This wealth and poverty from slavery and colonialism has not gone anywhere. That is the world we live in today. All of us, including me, I benefit from living in the UK. And so you can't deal with global inequality without dealing with that basic fundamental reality which shapes life and death today.
How far from mainstream politics at the moment is your view that trillions in reparations should be paid?
Well, I think it's not really a very, it's never going to be a mainstream view that the British should pay trillions in reparations. But that doesn't mean it's not the correct view. And in fact, as I said, I will tell you right now, I am very, 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 very unlikely that serious reparatory justice will be paid or even could be paid. But that's not really the point of reparations. The point is to show what that reality is, to show just how unequal the world is, and really to remind us that the world is shaped today, life and death is shaped today, by white supremacy.
And does it really all start with a government apology? Does that open the floodgates?
Well, that's the reason governments don't want to apologise. I mean, it should be quite simple to just say sorry. But sorry does bring culpability. And so that's why even Keir Starmer isn't going to come out and say, yes, I apologise. There's already been reparations cases in the courts. People have tried to sue. And so, yeah, the apology does actually start to make then legal responsibility, which is why I doubt we'll ever have a real apology from the UK either.
Professor Keyindi Andrews from Birmingham City University. Well, the UK Foreign Office declined our request for an interview in response. It did quote the Prime Minister Keir Starmer earlier today. In Samoa, he said, the slave trade and slave practice were abhorrent. We have had a very positive 2 days here talking about our shared challenges, but I should be clear, no discussions have been about money. There is one paragraph noting a call for a discussion. The next opportunity to look at that, he said, is at the UK Caribbean Forum next year. Now, as Israel's bombardment of Lebanon continues, the death toll there is soaring. Some 2,000 Lebanese people have been killed and many thousands more injured. In the past 5 weeks, more than a million people have been driven out of their homes. Israel says it is targeting Hezbollah, not the Lebanese people, but the US has said that civilian casualties have been far too high. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, reports on one of this war's young victims, a two-year-old girl called Ivana, who was badly wounded because of an Israeli missile strike and is now being cared for at a specialist burns unit in Beirut.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ziad Sleiman. I'm plastic and reconstructive surgeon in Lebanon. We are here in the only hospital in Lebanon in which we have the burn unit. Every day we are receiving calls, phone calls to transfer patients. We cannot take everybody. We are limited in beds. We try to take the babies, the ladies, the heavily burned patients and traumatized patients to give them the best chance to be treated.
I'm at the bedside of the youngest patient here. She's a tiny baby called Ivana, and she's been badly burned. Her face is bandaged. Her arms are bandaged.
Don't scare.
Her father, Mohammed, is with her now, comforting her. He's distracting her, taking her mind away from the pain.
Monday, 11 or 12, boom.
The strike was really close to us, about 10 meters from our house, right by our door. We were ready to move that morning. Our stuff was packed in the car. I saw my daughters playing on the balcony. Then the house shook, and I saw the little one. She was all black because of the dust from the missile. I picked her up. Something was exploding in the house, and the ceiling was falling in. I didn't understand what was happening. We left our house behind. My car, my motorbike. We took only our phones and $50.
Finish.
Doctor, you mentioned earlier, and I could see when we were with Ivana, she's full of character.
Yeah, she's so kind. She's so kind, Ivana. She's so so cute, so calm. Even when we changed the dressings, she does not shout and cry. Really, she's a special baby. She's so cute, so nice, so brave.
She's strong.
She's strong. She's so strong.
And now we're surrounded by a ward with bed after bed, people who've been injured by war.
Yes, honestly, it's very hard to deal with patients having traumas and burns due to war. First of all, they are victims. They are innocent. We do not have here soldiers. We have ladies, we have girls, we have babies and children. It's not their affair, their war. There's no war who ends with a winner. Every war ends with so many losers. Everybody will lose.
Dr. Ziad Sleiman talking to Orla Guerin in Beirut there, BBC World Service. Welcome back to NewsHour. Let's head to San Antonio, Texas, where NewsHour's James Menendez is reporting on the US elections. Texas isn't just about politics, though. It's also about its unique Tex-Mex cuisine. And James has been speaking to chef Johnny Hernandez, one of the biggest names in the business.
Well, it's a lovely late afternoon in San Antonio in autumn. Temperatures still high up in the 20s. Very balmy here, and we're sitting outside on a terrace at a restaurant called La Gloria, well-known here in the city, Mexican restaurant. And with the chef and owner, Johnny Hernandez, celebrity Mexican chef. I think so. I think that's fair enough, Johnny. And we've got lots of food in front of us, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But we're here really to talk about the sort of relationship between this part of Texas and also Mexico. And I think you're ideally placed to do it. Johnny, because your family's originally from Mexico. You were born here in Texas. So my first question to you is, and I know this is a bit provocative, are you the epitome of Tex-Mex?
Well, Dad said when I was growing up in his restaurants, I'm going to send you to chef school because I don't want you making tacos all your life. So I kind of messed up. I'm still making tacos, you know. But this Tex-Mex cuisine that we've grown up around, I think it's gone through a transition. But at the core of Tex-Mex food, it's fresh ingredients. It's fresh tortillas, handmade. You know, it's sometimes Tex-Mex food gets a bad rap sometimes, but it is just part of that evolution. And again, my restaurant, La Gloria.
Are you trying to do something a little bit different? Are you trying to sort of make it a bit more Mex than Tex?
I am more Mex-Tex than I am Tex-Mex, that's for sure. But I mean, that's always been my journey. And I've gone to the north of Mexico because that's where Dad was from and traveled the north. You know, which is carne asada, cabrito.
So there's that sort of goat, roasted meats. Mm-hmm.
Yes, a lot of grilled meats and stuff. And then Mom's family was from Michoacán, so much more corn-based diet, more central Mexico, where you see all the tamales, you see all the sopes, you see everything is in corn tortillas. And a lot of that is just, you know, the Texas terrain. You know, flour tortillas became kind of the vehicle for that workforce that needed a taco, right? Just get a taco, put it in, let's get on the road, let's get to work.
So tell us what we've got in front of us on the table here. I mean, wonderful colors, lots of reds and greens and the yellow of the tortilla chips. But these three dishes, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, is raw fish and seafood, a sort of ceviche, which to my mind is Peruvian.
Well, look, this is more of an aguachile.
So what is that? Just tell us what aguachile is.
So aguachile means fire water, ¿verdad? And the original aguachiles in Sonora along the coast on the Pacific side, you know. So, I mean, they're representative to me of a little bit of the Texas coast.
Everyone listening is just going to be, they're going to be salivating at all these descriptions. You famously cooked at the White House with President Obama. Did you serve him this sort of thing? What was on the menu then?
I served ceviche verde. So I had asked the president's staff if I could have the honor of serving the first tacos in the White House. So they granted me that permission.
Is that true? They never had tacos.
Not proper tacos. Not proper tacos. Not out of a silver urn, that's for sure.
Tex-Mex chef Johnny Hernandez in San Antonio. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. Votes have now been cast in Georgia's general election, which could determine whether the country moves closer to the European Union or towards Russian ideologies. The governing Georgian Dream Party is seeking to extend 12 years in office. There have already been claims of irregularities in the election. Shortly before we came on air, I spoke to our correspondent in Georgia, Rehan Dimitri, and asked her for the latest.
A short while ago, there was a press briefing by the Central Election Commission, and they gave preliminary results. According to those results, the governing Georgian Dream Party is in the lead with almost 53% of the vote. And the combined vote for all the opposition parties is less than 40%. But these are just preliminary figures, and the final results will be published on Sunday or on Monday. And it's interesting because polls closed at about 8 p.m. local time, and then exit polls were published, and they were quite kind of contradictory. So the governing party said, look, we won, we're in the lead, and they started celebrating. And the same thing happened with the opposition. They conducted their own exit polls. They were celebrating. And then these official results came, and now it's very, very quiet in Tbilisi. Usually when elections happen here, you get cars with Georgian flags and, you know, there's a lot of noise and celebration in the city. But it is extremely quiet now.
This was billed as an election which might decide whether Georgia heads towards Russia or towards the European Union. With this probable win by the Georgian Dream Party, what might happen?
Well, they will stay in power, and there will be a lot of disappointment among particularly, I think, young voters. We spoke to a number of young voters on Saturday at polling stations, and they were really, really hopeful for the victory for the opposition because they believe that the incumbent government is pulling the country in a wrong direction. Opposition supporters believe that the Georgian dream is acting in Russia's interests, because the relations with the European Union are really all-time low. And given that only last December 2023, Georgia received EU candidate status and people were euphoric. They thought that now their path for future is decided. But then in the past 6 or 7 months, there were a number of actions by the Georgian Dream government, and also very much so increased anti-Western rhetoric. And this is not what a lot of young voters want here.
So does this mean that the dream of the opposition to move the country closer to the European Union is over for now?
I think it's too soon to have this kind of a conclusion, because we haven't heard any response yet from, and in these elections there were 4 pro-Western coalitions that include several parties, each of those coalitions. So we haven't heard anything from those opposition leaders yet about their next move. But given how pivotal and important this election has been, my sense is that it's not game over yet for them.
That was the BBC's correspondent in Georgia, Rehan Dimitri. Nikolos Samkaradze joins us now from Tbilisi, live from the Georgian capital. He's a member of parliament for the governing Georgian Dream Party, which at the moment is projected to win and continue in government. Welcome, Mr. Samkaradze. What's your reaction to the latest on the results?
Well, thank you for having me. First of all, this is a tremendous result for Georgian Dream Party. We, for the first time in history, we got more than 53% of the votes, and that's a historically high result for our party. And this is an important achievement for the party and for the country. And we have a new renewed mandate by the people of Georgia to govern this country for another 4 years. To bring more economic prosperity, to continue on the economic development path, to preserve peace and stability in the country, and to move Georgia closer to the European Union.
I'll just point out briefly that these are still projected results at the moment. What do you say to those who campaigned against your party, who claim that Georgia faces now becoming less European, more Russian?
Well, that's those statements are groundless, because Georgia in the last 12 years has always acted in the interest of Georgia and has never acted in the interest of Russia. I want to remind you that Georgia is the country which does not have diplomatic relations with Russia, which does not have any political relations with Russia. So I think these talks about Georgia becoming more Russian are absolutely groundless and absurd.
Will you put accession talks to the EU on ice?
No. It's the EU that has put the accession talks on ice because of the law on transparency of NGOs, which we believe that does not contradict any European norm. And we are happy to take this law to any court in Europe, including the European Court of Human Rights or European Court of Justice, and to have the legal debate about the law in the court. And then if the court decides that the law has contravenes European norms, then we are happy to delete the norms that are in contravention. Other than that, we have not had any other reason for putting the accession talks on ice, and it was not us, but rather the European Union who has put the accession talks on hold.
Our correspondent in Tbilisi suggested that Georgian Dream's model was Viktor Orban in Hungary, anti-EU, socially conservative. Why would she say that?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's her personal opinion or perception, but people in Georgia perceive Georgian Dream completely in a different way. If she's implying that 53 percent of Georgians, the majority of Georgians are voting for the party that she described, then she is completely misplaced.
Can you govern for the possible 47% of people who are opposed to a lot of what you stand for, briefly?
Yes, of course. I mean, we are elected. We are a democratically elected government. Therefore, we are a government for the whole population of Georgia, and we will govern for the best interests of Georgian society and Georgian population.
Many thanks for coming on the program. That was Nikolos Samkaradze, who is an MP from the governing Georgian Dream Party, speaking to us live from Tbilisi. Now, in the ongoing civil war in Sudan, a pro-democracy group says the paramilitary rapid support forces have killed at least 124 people in El Jazeera State. The Wad Madani Resistance Committee says 100 others were injured when RSF fighters raided a village on Friday. The opposing side in this war, the Sudanese army, has accused its enemy of committing genocide and ethnic cleansing. I've been speaking to the US envoy to Sudan, Tom Perriello, about the shocking scale of the emergency in Sudan. I asked him first what he knew about this latest attack.
The reports are absolutely horrific, and sadly, we see this every couple of weeks where we see atrocities, and particularly by the rapid support forces. We see people continuing to suffer from both famine and cholera, but we have seen several very acute attacks targeting civilians just here in the last couple of days.
The RSF say they are targeting villages that are housing militia. Do you believe those claims?
The RSF really does not have credibility at all on any of its claims about protecting civilians. We've seen not only collective punishment against civilians and entire communities, we've seen within this war ethnic cleansing, particularly in the Darfur area of the Masalit, and use of both starvation and sexual slavery as a weapon of war.
It's true, though, isn't it, that there have been atrocities committed by both sides in this war, by the official army as well?
That's correct. And we have sanctioned just in the last week individuals involved in procuring weapons from nefarious sources to fuel some of the atrocities on the army side, including efforts to deny food and medicine to large parts of the population of the Sudanese people, where over 20 million people face acute hunger. So we have seen atrocities on both sides. But in this case, we are hearing reports of acute attacks and murdering of civilians by the RSF, which has been a pattern. And we need to understand that all of those that are part of the RSF network need to be held accountable for these abuses. And we need to make sure to get to the bottom of the facts in this case.
We're a long way from that, though, aren't we? The United Nations says this is one of the greatest humanitarian crises on Earth, if not the greatest at the moment. It's overshadowed by conflicts elsewhere. What is the U.S. position on Sudan?
Well, the United States has really been leading under the Biden administration, but it's been a lonely place to be and drawing attention to the Sudan. I've rarely, if ever, seen a crisis of this proportion get so little attention from the international community and from our partners. We've certainly been leading the way on sanctioning some of these horrific generals doing these atrocities. We have given more than the rest of the world combined in terms of humanitarian aid and medicine, some of which is getting through thanks to diplomatic efforts, but way too many parts of the country continue to have no access at all to basic food and medicine. So the United Nations, the African Union, and others really do need to show much bolder leadership in this space to stand with the people of Sudan. 50 million people, many of whom have had to flee across borders into neighboring countries under truly horrific circumstances. And the world has really been asleep on this crisis, and we need people to wake up very quickly.
One of the issues is that this is very much a conflict behind closed doors, as it were. You yourself, as US Special Envoy for Sudan, haven't even been able to go to the country.
We're hoping to be there here in the next couple of weeks, but it is a situation that I would argue is happening in plain sight. It's true that it's very difficult to get media crews on the ground, so we don't have some of the coverage we would normally have. But there's no secret about what's happening. It is true that this is a complicated war with a lot of history, but on some level, it's just a question of choice. This was not a famine that was created by a tsunami or a disease or hitting crops or a drought. It was a choice by the RSF to destroy crops and harvests and warehouses, and now a decision by the army and the government authorities in Port Sudan to put up every barrier possible to food and medicine getting to the most vulnerable people.
That was the U.S. envoy to Sudan, Tom Perriello. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour, live from London. Stay tuned if you can. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour live from the BBC. Israeli forces have now withdrawn from a hospital in northern Gaza a day after storming it. Earlier, the Hamas-run health ministry said the army had detained dozens of male medical staff and patients in Kamal Adwan Hospital, one of the last medical facilities still functioning in the area. Videos online showed the director of the hospital, who'd earlier been detained himself, mourning the death of his 8-year-old son, reportedly killed during the Israeli siege. The head of the World Health Organization has warned of a catastrophic situation at Gaza's medical facilities. Yolande Nell, the BBC's Middle East correspondent in Jerusalem, has been telling me the latest.
We've heard that after one day, Israeli forces have now withdrawn from this hospital complex, Kamal Adwan, in the north of the Gaza Strip. Gaza's health ministry has said that the troops detained about 30 male medical staff, has kept them in detention, as well as some of the patients. There are three medical facilities in the north of the Gaza Strip that have really been operating under very difficult conditions, struggling on. And there is now some footage that has come out, which we can't immediately verify, but that seems to show damage to several buildings after the Israeli forces withdrew. And we've got medics at this hospital saying at least two children died in the intensive care unit after Israeli fire hit yesterday and hit the generators, hit the oxygen station. We've been hearing that three nurses were injured during the raid. Three ambulances were destroyed, according to local health officials. The World Health Organization has come out with some very strong comments, saying that it cannot stress loudly enough, hospitals must be shielded from conflict at all times. Any attack of healthcare facilities is a violation of international humanitarian law.
And reports that the hospital director's own young son was killed in the raid of the hospital.
There are some very distressing images that come out that show apparently his wife over the body of their 8-year-old son wrapped up in a shroud. We know that there were these reports that the director had been detained. Initially, he said that he was taken off to a tank, that he was interrogated, particularly about some of his statements to the media. But then he is one of those that was later released among 14 that were released by the Israeli army. Now, the Israeli military hasn't specifically commented on the detentions at the hospital and what's happened there, the latest. But it did say yesterday that it was acting in that area based on intelligence about the presence of terrorists, it said, and terrorist infrastructure. And it said that it had previously allowed the evacuation of some patients. We did hear that the World Health Organization had taken some critically ill patients to another hospital just a few hours before this Israeli raid began.
And that's the official justification, that the Israeli army was trying to get to terrorists.
That's all we've heard in relation to Kamal Adwan Hospital. Previously, in the north of Gaza, the Israeli military has been saying in general that it began this new military offensive there to try to root out regrouping Hamas fighters. And it has been a very intense military operation still ongoing. What we've been hearing from the Gaza-based health authorities, some 800 people have been killed in the past 3 weeks.
Yolande Nell, returning to our main story, Iran has played down the impact of a series of Israeli airstrikes overnight last night on military facilities there. But hardliners in Tehran quickly called for retaliation, with the foreign ministry saying the country had a duty to defend itself. What officials there might privately be thinking is that they were fortunate that Israel heeded US advice not to hit bigger, riskier targets and compel an escalation in the conflict. How big a role did the US play? Thomas Nides was US ambassador to Israel between 2021 and 2023. Did he think there'd been a sigh of relief in Washington that the Israeli strikes on Iran were relatively limited?
I don't know if it's a sigh of relief. I mean, I think the reality of this is the United States stood firmly behind Israel in their defense. And obviously, you know, none of us like any military confrontation. Certainly this was started by the Iranians. Obviously, the Israelis were going to retaliate. They did retaliate. And now we'll see what will come of it. Listen, we wake up every day. None of us like any of this. Obviously, we want things to calm down in the Middle East. We want the Iranians and Hezbollah and Hamas to stop what they're doing. And we obviously want to make sure that the innocent people who have got caught in the middle of this stop dying and get the food they need.
How much diplomatic muscle do you think America had to exert on Israel to limit the targets?
Again, I don't think it's a question of muscle. It's a question of we sent a very strong message to Israel and to Tehran that we had Israel's back, including, as you know, by sending our most sophisticated defense systems to Israel to protect it for the attack. So the question of, you know, what we told Israel to do, Israel makes their own decisions. They'll make their own decisions on how to protect themselves, their own decisions on what to react to. Israel had 180 ballistic missiles shot into Tel Aviv just a couple weeks ago. They were going to retaliate. There was no question about that. We are there to support Israel and to protect Israel. And I'll leave all the rest of the speculation to others.
Despite the killing last week of the Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, the fighting continues in Gaza. To what extent do you think Gaza has fallen down the diplomatic priority list after the tensions with Iran and the invasion of Lebanon?
Oh, I don't think it's dropped anywhere down, certainly down our priority list, and certainly not down, I think, the hostage families list. We got to get these hostages home. We've got to get the hostages home. We've got to end the war. We've got to start rebuilding Gaza. You know, we need to rebuild, I think, the importance of Israel's place on the world stage. These are all important aspects of part of this. So I don't think it's dropped down whatsoever, but it's got to be resolved without question.
You're off, I hear, to Philadelphia to campaign for Kamala Harris. How badly do you think these wars have affected her prospects, especially in crucial swing states, if Arab American voters choose to sit on their hands?
Well, first of all, I'm going to go and volunteer, like many Americans are doing, both for Harris and for Trump. And I intend to express my personal views on why I think it's important that Kamala Harris runs and wins for the presidency. Listen, I think every constituency is important. The Jewish constituency, the Arab American constituency, the Black constituency, the women's constituency. Listen, I think it's everything matters. It's a game of inches. It's as they like to say, it's tight as a tick, close margin of error, whatever, you know, insane thing that pollsters now say about campaigns. And so every vote matters, and we're going to work to make sure that every vote counts.
Thomas Nides, who was the U.S. ambassador to Israel between 2021 and 2023, and he brings to a close this edition of NewsHour for a Saturday evening UK time. Thank you for listening. Goodbye for now.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts. If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.